Ralph McInerney is one of today's most noted Catholic philosophers and authors. He has taught at the University of Notre Dame since 1955, and since 1978 has been the Michael P. Grace Professor of Medieval Studies. He also serves as director of the Jacques Maritain Center at Notre Dame, the author of a number of important works on St. Thomas Aquinas, and one of our most noted Thomistic philosophers. He is a fellow of the Pontifical Academy of St. Thomas Aquinas. 20 years ago, McInerney helped found Crisis Magazine, a publication that addresses problems facing contemporary society from the standpoint of the Catholic tradition. In 1999, McInerney was invited to give the prestigious Gifford Lectures at the University of Edinburgh. His series of talks on the importance of natural theology was later published under the title Characters in Search of Their Author. Recently, Ralph McInerney was appointed to President Bush's Council for Arts and the Humanities. Alongside his academic career, McInerney has had another successful career as author of the best-selling and internationally acclaimed Father Dowling Mysteries, which were also made into a series for public television. Born in Minneapolis in 1929, just as the Great Depression was beginning, he grew up Catholic in a predominantly Protestant community. With 9 children in the family, times were hard, but not austere. When he wasn't in school, much of life for young Ralph was spent outside, playing in the parks and open spaces of Minnesota. In 1946, he joined the Marine Corps and later returned to Minnesota to take a bachelor's degree from the St. Paul Seminary. Realizing that the priesthood was not his vocation, he began graduate studies in philosophy at the University of Minnesota, earning a Master of Arts degree. He completed his graduate studies at Laval University in Canada, where his mentor was Charles de Koninck. At the University of Minnesota, he met his wife, Connie. They married in 1953 and had 7 children, 6 of whom survived. Connie passed away in May of 2002 in the 50th year of their marriage. McInerney's first teaching job was at Creighton University in Omaha, and then it was on to Notre Dame in 1955. The rest is history. In 1963, seeking to supplement what in those days was a modest salary of a professor, Ralph returned to one of his lifelong interests, fiction. He first published in popular magazines, where he learned the craft. He sold his first story to Redbook 6 months after undertaking to write fiction seriously, went on to novels, and eventually to mysteries. His first novel was Jolly Rogerson, a black comedy that examines the notion of success and failure. That book marked the beginning of his career as a novelist. And in 1976, he began penning the internationally popular Father Dowling Mysteries, the Andrew Broom Mysteries, and the Sister Mary Teresa Mysteries. With his combination of philosophical rigor, popular storytelling, and deep concern for the problems facing modern society, McInerney occupies a unique place among modern philosophers. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a conversation with Professor Ralph McInerney.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Ralph.
Good to be here.
There's this American Catholic philosopher who teaches at Notre Dame, right? And he writes things like this. Jacques Maritain's teaching on the relation between the philosophy of nature and experimental science, surely one of the most carefully worked out of the Thomistic solutions, was not thought adequate by Charles de Koninck of Laval or the River Forest Dominicans, right? And then there's this mystery writer who lives in the Midwest, right? And he writes things like this. It took nearly a quarter of an hour, and the towel was no good at all. Finally, he used his bare hands, pressing his thumbs relentlessly down as she kicked and squirmed and did not easily let go of her grip on life. And then there's this commentator on public affairs who lives in Indiana, and he writes things like this: to advise Catholics to ignore clear magisterial teaching is to advise them to reject the clear teaching of Vatican II. How ironic that the council should be invoked as a warrant for dissenting from the magisterium which the council endorsed. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, all three of those guys are you. Are they the same guy?
Sure, absolutely, yeah. No, I used to, you know, when I began writing, and I would, the way I described it, I would go down, you know, here my day job, so to speak, of my family, that I would go down and engage in. So it was as if I was doing something quite different. And using my mind, using my imagination in a way which you don't normally in philosophy, and it seemed to be a vacation from that. And in several senses, one almost culpable, that I wasn't doing these other things when I might have been doing them, and freeing. And when I would go down there, I'm kind of pooped, you know, at 10 in the evening after, as I say, a full day putting the kids to bed and visiting with my wife and so on. But when I would go down those stairs, it was as if the sun was coming up. It was like a new day. You know, and all my energy would come back. I was young then. It would come back, and I would go at it. I mean, I loved it. It was just wonderful. But there was a sense of separation, almost two levels, you know, the underground man writing these commercial stories and so forth. There came a time, and I don't know exactly when it was, when I began to see these were part of a single thing, you know, me, for one thing, which they already were, but somehow they hung together in ways that are not terribly easy to explain, but I began to think of models of what I was or was trying to be, and I'd have to go for European models. And you take someone like Ortega, or you take someone like Unamuno, you take some Italian writers, even you know, people that are mainly known as novelists like Manzoni, and look at book that he wrote, La Morale Cattolica, that was huge, kind of philosophical work and so forth. And suddenly I began to see that, you know, we as philosophers have defined ourselves in a way that is really confining. Julian Marias is another one, a great Spanish philosopher about my age, but he had an essay that really struck me and was called Philosophy as Dramatic Form. And he begins by saying, you know, we in the 20th century, as he was writing then, we have this conception of philosophy as a piece in mind or in philosophical review or a treatise, you know, like Hume or whatever. And he said, let's think about it. How did philosophy begin? Philosophy began as poetry, it began as prayers, it began as epigrams, it began as dialogue. And he went through all of the genres that philosophy has employed over its history. And from that point of view, the 20th century, at least analytic American, Anglo-American philosophy, could look exiguous. You know, here you had this very dry as dust, sort of unrelated to anything else. Although many, you know, analytic philosophers were very cultivated people, but it had nothing to do with their philosophy.
Ralph, this is fascinating, this notion that you've put forward, that there's some kind of unity among the various fields in which you've worked, not just unity, a pros-hen unity, that mm-hmm. coming because you're the person who did it all, but a unity in conception. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they do appear in different voices. You do the police in different voices. The mysteries come in a different voice from the philosophy, from the social commentary. And is that just a writerly technique or something different happening in you when you do fiction? Mm-hmm. Or when you do the poetry that you've seem to have returned to in recent mm-hmm. years?
Well, obviously there are differences, but it seems to me that, you know, that old French adage that style is the man, there is an inner unity, it seems to me, or there can be, in terms of what you're coming out of, your outlook on life, I think, is probably the sustaining kind of unifier. But, you know, I think, for example, of Aristotle's notion of the plurality of modes of discourse, The medieval and Renaissance conception was that you move from apodictic discourse through dialectical discourse through rhetorical discourse, and you end up with poetry. And poetry was considered to be a kind of argument. And, of course, that's the conception of metaphor that that Aristotle has, that you learn something from a metaphor. There's something discursive about it. I've thought about that, too, in terms of serious and commercial fiction. You know, how should one regard the relationship between them? Maybe you say schlock, and it's just, you know, you're doing it for commercial and venal reasons, and on the one hand, and on the other, what? Dwight MacDonald, a name that isn't paid much attention to anymore, although recently there was a long essay on him in what Human Events. But he had a little booklet, which I can't find anymore, called Mass Cult and Mid Cult. And it was this typical snobbish kind of thing, that there's a high kind of writing that is for us guys, and then there's this sort of unwashed writing that other people do, and there's just no traffic between them. There is an essay, it was based on a series of lectures that he gave at Cambridge by C.S. Lewis called Experiment and Criticism, in which he raised that question as a professor of literature, well, what is literature? And he began by proposing as kind of rule of thumb, literature is anything that you would read again. And it's very, you get, in Cyril Connolly's Enemies of Town, what is it?
Not
Enemies of Prama, you get a similar sort of suggestion that there is this spectrum, and that you can locate things along the line so that there's a continuity and not a disruption between them. There are some things that would fall off entirely. You wouldn't read them again. Huh? But what Lewis, by putting that question, he's asking himself, what is it that brings us back to something? Why would we reread? And it seems to me this is what we learn from fiction. It's what you learn when you're writing it, the infinite possibilities in human action, the mystery of human action, of human personality. From a philosophical point of view, we tend to move towards the general and the universal, and you try to capture essences and genres and this kind of thing. And when you've got that, the individual become instances of that, so they tend to be depreciated, it can sometimes seem. But if you think of the way in which we reflect on human action in moral philosophy, where you're trying to come up with generalities and with rules and principles and so forth, what you're talking about could never be exhausted by that kind of discussion. And that's part of the theory in someone like Aristotle, huh? That the prudential order just opens up into the singular and will be infinitely various and in a good way. That is, the variety can be varieties of goodness and not just variations off of goodness. So it seems to me that when you explore characters and action in fiction, that's what you're doing. You're pondering just the mysteriousness of human lives. And, you know, they're inexhaustible existentially. And within fiction, you know, you're never going to run out of possibility. Just the surprises and the glory often of human action, or the depths to which it can descend. So that I've often thought that what fiction does for us, both in the reading of it and in the writing of it, is a way of meditating on what it is to be a human person, to be a free, responsible individual.
But Ralph, let me push you a little bit on this, because this is something actually that relates to some of the questions I have about literature in your own lifetime. There's an equivocation involved, of course, in moving from the final mystery of human action to the writing of mystery novels. Mm-hmm. We're doing some equivocation on the word mystery there. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that for all that Dwight MacDonald was participating in a uniquely 1950s sort of highbrow snobbery, he was expressing something that we might take as still true. which is to say that it's present even if you see all these things as apparently you do on a spectrum, right? Still there is a difference between one end of the spectrum and the other. They may be strung on a string together, but there is still a distinction to be made between the two ends.
It seems to be one of the disruptive things in the Academy now is the effort to say Tarzan is every bit as important as Shakespeare. And so that would be the trivialization of this connection, because there's no connection then. You're saying there are no standards anyway, so you just you decide what the classics is, what the classics are, and your criteria are probably political or ideological in some way. So let's quit kidding ourselves that Conrad and Shakespeare are really more important than, Tarzan. I'm certainly not suggesting anything like that. What I have in mind, though, and Ortega y Gasset, his Revolt of the Masses, I reread that some years back, expecting to feel again the delight that I felt when I first read it. And I have it in a 25-cent paperback, which is not unimportant. And in it, what Ortega is expressing from the very first paragraphs is an utter and total contempt for ordinary people. This is what bothers me about this thing. I don't think there's any other way to put it. He talks about all of these people coming into our museums and coming into theaters and pretending to be able to read and so forth. And what he's suggesting, what the modern in art is to ensure that the normal expectations of art on the part of most people will be thwarted. That this is what the note of modernity, that you refuse to offer any of the normal consolations as they were thought to be of art, but it's kind of in your face sort of thing. There's a wonderful book called The Invention of the Masses or something like that. It was T.S. Eliot lectures at Cambridge some years back. I'll think of the author. But it's tremendous from the point of view of the data that he gathered of people, artists like D.H. Lawrence, who hated the ordinary man and who dreamt of herding people into the Crystal Palace and gassing them. I mean, just dreadful sort of thing. And he described people on the street, how loathsome they were and so forth. You figure you cannot be a writer and have that attitude towards people. That's a generalization. But, imagine the contrast between that notion of writing and Trollope or Jane Austen just about anyone you like. They are writing in a way that they hope will engage anyone and everyone in some sense. So that, there's a lot more there than, say, the initial reading would give you.
Of course, there are writers who have done this, but the question is, are there writers who can do it now? Well, I mean, there's an argument about the decline of fiction in our own lifetimes that's not entirely Jacques Barzin, among others who are making arguments like this, not entirely attributable to the snobbery of 1950s intellectuals or the failure of education, but the failure of the novel, the coming to an end of the novel as the fundamental work of art of the civilization, which it for English speakers it had become in the 19th century. And your career tracks some of that. I mean, there is a distinction to be made. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it strikes me there is a distinction to be made between a novel like your 1973 The Priest and 1994's Mom and Dad.
Yeah, well, I was trying to do something quite different. Both.
Well, right, but no, why are you trying to do something quite different? Yeah.
No, it is true. One of the attractions, I'll have to tell you, one of the attractions of writing mysteries is that everybody reads them. I mean, the letters you get about your mystery, with the whole spectrum of society, you're not writing for a certain class. So that you can, it's like Green's Entertainments. I mean, you're taking melodrama, and you're using it, but you're trying to boost it beyond its possibility, giving things that normally aren't given just in a thriller and the like. It seems to me now, when I began to to write, if you looked at the bestseller list, there wasn't a single thriller or mystery mentioned. If you look at them now, there's practically nothing else. Now, something has happened, clearly has happened, and I think part of it has been deliberate, that this thing that I've mentioned, a lot of writers have kind of steered away from addressing the reader. You know, they're addressing English professors or critics or, you know, somebody else. And they're deliberately writing this sort of in need of interpretation kind of thing. So they've cut themselves off from this demotic kind of writing that I've been referring to. And that has created schlock. I mean, you know, you see all these novels that glow in the dark. I mean, on planes, you see people with these big chubby things, you know, they're just flipping through them. If you ever try to read some of those things, it's punishing. I mean, it's as if, you know, some room full of gorillas were given typewriters and they ended up writing a novel of some kind. Now, there are, I'm sure, exceptions to that, but they're quite deliberately based at a very low level of just diversion.
But are we going to blame all of that on the treason of the clerks? Are we going to blame all of that sociological fact?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and the way we're going to do it is by saying that they're not just huddled in Greenwich Village or something like that, but that they have affected the educational system in this country all the way down. Yeah? You get a reading Flannery O'Connor, who was talking about a dispute as to whether some 20th century novel could be read in high school and whether it was corrupting of youth and so forth. It's a very interesting kind of a reaction to that. And her idea was, look, what kids in high school ought to be reading are not the things that are just coming out. Huh? They ought to be reading 19th century fiction, 20th century fiction, and so forth, so that when they come to current literature, maybe they're prepared for things that would be a little surprising if they just started there.
The mention of Flannery O'Connor brings me to one last chance to try and suggest there's something sociological going on as well, something mm-hmm. in the failure of the novel as an explanatory device. And the mention of Flannery O'Connor makes me want to ask you about what happened to Catholic fiction in your lifetime. Well, there was a moment there in part out of the great waves of conversion, but also the existence of a kind of Catholic subculture in the late 1950s and early 1960s, where it looked like Catholicism was about to capture American literature. It was going to be the place to go for seriousness, kind of whether it was moral seriousness or the gesture of seriousness in popular fiction or intellectual seriousness, which is why Robert Lowell espoused it. And that's the world into which you came as a writer. And it changed yes. very, very quickly. I mean, I think from that great set of writers of people like J.F. Powers and Flannery O'Connor, the heirs are, I only see two who come in at the end and survive, you and Mary Gordon.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of it, I think, what was going on there? It seems to me that in a very special way, here you had a set of criteria for appraising and understanding the actions that were being narrated in the story, so that the notion of sin and not just someone making a mistake and running into misfortune and so forth, this notion of a responsibility beyond this life even. I mean, you think of The End of the Affair and you think of The Heart of the Matter and so forth. I mean, these Catholic novels of Graham Greene were just... you know, they put that right on your plate, you know. And it was something that, it was Catholic, but it wasn't narrowly Catholic, because it seems to me it's what in Dostoevsky struck people. And at that time, take someone like James Jones, who was a very serious kind of writer. I don't think he had a lot of equipment, but what he was looking for was a way of interpreting the events that he put forward. You know, the Pearl Harbor novel is really, it's got something almost inchoative about it. He's looking for some set of principles that will enable him to understand this. And I think it's thin in that regard.
You know, from Here to Eternity.
Yeah. It's thin. And I think what this other thing, that it brought back in a deeper sense of moral seriousness and then religiously.
Oh, I see. So the literature was feeling thin even to its own practitioners at that moment before, and Catholicism seemed to offer a world of thickness.
Yeah, and I think you could see that in Death Comes for the Archbishop and in Shadows on the Rock. You know, here you have two of the most Catholic novels ever produced in this country by a non-Catholic, you know, who occupied this, looking for or finding in this specific Catholic outlook some kind of intensified version of what you have to have in fiction and what had been thinning out. Now, what happened there, it seems to me, is sociological, your favorite term. I mean, something happened to the Catholic Church. Something happened to Catholic self-understanding. Something happened to their sense of confidence. And it's one of the bad effects and the unintended effects of Vatican II. And I think there was this kind of departure from any sense of a special viewpoint, or the effort on the part of Catholic writers to write as much like someone who wasn't a Catholic could possibly write. You know, so there was this this kind of inner betrayal of their own lights, of just pushing that to one side.
You wrote a book in 1998 called What Went Wrong with Vatican II. So, you know, this gives me an opportunity to put the question, what went wrong with Vatican II?
Well, I think one has to distinguish between the council itself and what went wrong. And I was in Rome for the second extraordinary synod meeting in 1985, which was on the 20th anniversary of the close of the council. And that was right after the so-called Ratzinger Report had appeared a few months before. But it was the first official recognition that things had gone wrong. And there was a discussion of the true and the false spirit of Vatican II. Now, in that intervening 20 years, of course, many of us made that kind of claim, but it was then just, you know, one voice against other voices. But here it seemed to be was an official recognition that there had been a use of the council for purposes very different from what the council itself had had in mind.
Well, let's distinguish those. What is the use that you saw, the misuse?
Well, I'm thinking of something that was very widespread. People say, Vatican II says, and then fill in the blank, and you get all kinds of outrageous things. And many of the unauthorized and uncontemplated liturgical changes were justified in terms of Vatican II. That would be a kind of garden-level variety of it. But my own argument in that book is that what happened happened in 1968 with the appearance of Humanae Vitae. And there had been a 3-year interval from the end of the council until the appearance of that encyclical and the reiteration of the traditional judgment on artificial contraception. During those 3 years, it had seemed to be an open question. There was the commission that had been expanded by Paul VI to advise him on that matter. Originally, the idea was there was this estrogen pill, and the question that was raised was, does this fall under the ban? But as the discussion went on, it was the ban in all of its amplitude that was being questioned and discussed. And that commission, as you know, advised that there should be a change in church teaching on that. And then the encyclical completely ignored that, or didn't take that advice and reiterated. What happened then was the emergence of something that was absolutely unique in the history of the church, and that was a tradition of dissent within the church. There's never been anything like this, where you had the class of theologians defining themselves as kind of the ombudsmen that would intervene between the magisterium and the people and guard us against the teaching of the church, and in effect interpret it out of existence. There was published by the American Catholic Theological Society in 1977 a book that was commissioned in 1972 called Human Sexuality. And if you ever wanted to look at a handbook for the dissolution of Christian morality, that would be it. I mean, it's just amazing. All of the elements of Catholic sexual morality, and I would say Christian sexual morality, were treated in that book, and a complete reversal as to what kind of a moral judgment you would put on them. They gave something like six criteria for appraising a human act, which were just unbelievable. Is it other regarding? Is it joyous? And this sort of thing. I mean, you could justify anything on that basis, and people did. But what happened, at any rate, was there was this tremendous outcry when Humanae Vitae appeared, and theologians began to see themselves as in opposition to the Magisterium. And to this day, it turns on the question of contraception.
Well, that's the mechanism by which then Vatican II went wrong. But why did it go wrong?
Original sin, maybe?
That's one of those things with which one can explain everything.
The extenuating circumstances, and I think that has to be said, that there was this interval when in perfectly good faith, people were raising questions about this, and it seemed to be an open question, and that was prolonged for 3 years after the close of the council was, I think, in retrospect, one of the most unfortunate things, because you got this buildup of expectation, and you got people who had committed themselves to the view that it is going to change, not simply as an opinion of theirs, but it got into teaching, it got into marriage preparation, it got into preaching, it got into the confessional, so that it was almost as if up until noon tomorrow, something is seriously wrong, but at noon tomorrow it's going to be all right. You know, a very strange way of looking at human behavior. So when that did happen, when the encyclical came out, I understood. I remember vividly. I was mowing the lawn when Humanae Vitae appeared. It's when I said to myself, "This is my material," and the novel I wrote that came out some years later, The Priest, swung around the events of Humanae Vitae. For me, imaginatively and intellectually, it was the moment in post-conciliar history where things began to unravel. Why did they unravel? If there's any area of human life where we're going to look for a way of not doing what we ought to do, it's in the realm of sexuality, it seems to me. And the Christian teaching there is so liberating and fulfilling a one. The sacramental view of marriage is so ennobling that it just seems to me tragic that this has, in effect, been eroded by this kind of controversy. Because what you noticed was that people were talking about the relationships between men and women, wives, husbands, parents, and children, primarily in terms of criteria that were coming from the secular society and not out of our own tradition. And I think it was a matter of being influenced by the culture in which we find ourselves, which is a continuing problem, probably an exacerbated problem with respect to evangelizing.
Why did you found Crisis magazine? You and Michael Novak founded Crisis in
20 years ago. 20 years ago, yeah.
Was it in part to address this situation?
No. It was prompted by the fact that the bishops were then issuing letters on the economy and on national defense, which adopted one of several perfectly plausible notions as to how these things should be addressed. And it looked very much like what the Democratic Party would say about these things. And what we wanted to do was to point out that being a Catholic did not entail holding those views. And in the bishops' letters, they would mention at the end that these were their prudential judgments and it was up to individuals to accept or reject, which I find that an odd kind of letter to put out. And it's kind of hard to know how seriously they meant this kind of disclaimer at the end. But we took it quite seriously and argued that political liberalism was not entailed by being a Catholic. And at that moment, it looked like this was an important thing to establish. The original title was Catholicism in Crisis. That was the original title of the magazine.
How does this dissent that you've described, that took over the theological community, and people offering themselves up as representative Catholics and then dissenting from what appears to be church teaching. How does that differ from, say, you writing an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying the Pope is wrong on the death penalty?
Oh, I didn't say that. The Pope is right on the death penalty because he's never denied that the state has the right to invoke the death penalty. He's making a prudential point as to whether it's wise in the present circumstances to avail ourselves of that. And there might be a very deep analysis of modern culture in terms of his notion of the culture of death that explains that. But there's never been any question, any statement on his part in Evangelium Vitae or in the relevant articles of the Catechism, which were rewritten in the light of Evangelium Vitae, which denies that right on the part of the state. So it's more, I think, a prudential level. Is it wise for us now? Just as one could say in the South, would it be wise, you know, to invoke the death penalty in certain circumstances where it looked as if only a certain race was being singled out for this kind of treatment? You might wonder, maybe there should be a moratorium for a while and think about that. But you're not denying the right. You're questioning the wisdom of the invocation of it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your philosophy and maybe talk a little bit about natural law and this kind of analysis of moral act. That your first book, wasn't it, was The Logic of Analogy. That was your first book of all, your writing. Why is analogy? What's the point of analogy? Why have you kept coming back to it? Three other of your books have the word analogy in the title?
A couple do, yeah. Well, I think the reason is it's a whole kind of epistemology. I was mainly interested in the logical dimensions of analogy, but what it says to me is this. It's a kind of rock-bottom Aristotelian view as to how the human mind works, that there are certain things that everybody gets hold of, certain truths, theoretical and practical, that everyone has in their possession, however implicitly, and that what formal philosophy does is to move on from those. These provide us with a kind of a set of criteria, when they're articulated and teased out of what everyone implicitly knows, they provide us with criteria for appraising philosophical system, so that a philosophical system that's radically out of whack with those, that tells against the system, not about what most people know. Now, I locate natural law in this pre-philosophical awareness of what counts as right and wrong. And what it doesn't mean, of course, is that everyone's born with a set of principles in his mind and they're just explicitly there and you invoke them. What it means is that just as in any argument, theoretical or practical, when two people are talking and they're in disagreement, obviously the fact that they're talking implies some kind of agreement. Huh? And the language that they're using implies all kinds of agreements about the world in which they are and what communication is. And I think what we're after when we talk about first principles, whether in the theoretical and the practical order, are again not what anyone is likely just to say down at McDonald's if you pinch them or something, but what will come out in any dialectical discussion of a very concrete problem. And that you'll find that someone who wants to be an antinomian, or somebody who wants to, in the case of the sophists in antiquity, who want to, in effect, say that what's true for me is true for me, and what's true for you is true for you, and that's a position, that this is an incoherent position, and that you can't even state it coherently without, in effect, denying it. And natural law principles are like that. They emerge out of the interchange of human agents concerned about what we ought to do. And the suggestion that is sometimes made on a theoretical level that anything goes, or whatever you want to do is right for you and so forth, it won't wash in terms of that kind of discussion. And language, which rightly has been emphasized by any number of contemporary philosophers, is the key. I mean, Aristotle in the fourth book of the Metaphysics, when he's talking about the defense of the principle of contradiction against the sophists, he finally comes down to language as the rock-bottom argument, that in order to state the objection, you have to assume that words mean something and not the opposite. So you're invoking the principle of contradiction on the level of signification, at least, in order to talk about it. I think that we when we talk about language, it can sound like just a sort of overlay of thinking and the like, but when it's used in this fashion, we're talking about vocal expression, knowledge, and what we know. It's the whole package. So that the appeal to language is to get us anchored in the reality that is common to all of us. And natural law is simply that kind of a claim, that there are certain unavoidable recognitions about good and evil that will show up when people argue about some concrete, beginning to argue about a concrete problem.
The structure of speech, conversation, the structure of thought, and the structure of reality, are these one? Are they analogous?
No, but they're related. And, you know, that's the great quarrel between Aristotle and Plato as to whether what comes first and whether there's some kind of one-to-one correspondence between the way in which we know and the way things are. One of the issues of analogy is the way all that gets reversed, that in the use of analogical signification to talk about the divine attributes, for example, is to take language terms which have their native habitat in very everyday and ordinary setting, and we already know their meanings, and we extrapolate from those, we extend from those, and use them to talk about God. So that from the point of view of the language, it looks as if he's the last thing that gets named, or that the word applies to him least appropriately. But then when you reflect on the things that you're talking about, you realize that though in order to call God wise, we have to figure out what we mean by calling Socrates wise and then push on from there. Wisdom is found most perfectly in God. So you reverse the order, and the last thing named is the first thing in reality.
And it's this understanding of analogy, isn't it, though, that, say, the great Protestant theologian of the 20th century, Karl Barth, would call satanic, would say is fundamentally anti-Christian.
Well, what I would say is let's read the parables. You know, let's go to the Gospels and ask ourselves, how does our Lord teach? And he tells stories about very ordinary occurrences. And obviously, the prodigal son, I mean, he's telling this story, and it's about sons and fathers and misbehavior and forgiveness and the like. Obviously, it's more than a story. He's trying to tell us something about something else. It's the only way the human mind can work. We have to move off of things that are close up and easily grasped and extrapolate from them to what is intrinsically more important but more obscure to us. To deny anything like analogy is in effect what it leads to, I think, theologically, is fideism, because you're just saying there's this way of talking that belongs to religion and it has no relationship to the way we talk about anything else. That's schizophrenic, it seems to me. And I don't think it matches anything like Christianity, which is so incarnate. Huh? I mean, why did Christ become man? To give us something to look at and to listen to, and figure he's sufficiently like us so that he's showing us what we ought to do. Without that kind of very palpable sensory appeal, the human mind has got nothing to work with. And faith would have nothing, to pin onto.
What do American Catholic philosophers do that non-American Catholic philosophers don't do?
Well, you know, it'd be easier to, I suppose, put it in terms of theology and the influence of American thinking on the Declaration on Religious Liberty of Vatican II, with John Courtney Murray's contribution to that. So that, you know, the whole post-revolutionary, French Revolutionary question as to how you work out a pluralist society in terms of people with quite different religious outlooks and so forth without getting into a theocracy or one side beating up on the other. And there had to be clearly an appeal to some common base that was more fundamental than the differences among religious believers. And Murray's own view of the United States was that the founders and did have, and we should have, a kind of base morality that enabled us to make appraisals about public actions, at least, as to what was in and what was out, what was acceptable and what was not, that did not appeal overtly to any religious criteria. And it's a very powerful argument that he makes. And it is, I would say, a natural law argument. You're saying there are certain principles of right and wrong that go beyond the merest banalities that you can arrive at agreement on among human beings just because of what they are and the way things are, and that these are short of explicitly religious or supernatural beliefs. That's always been the Catholics. If you look at any moral encyclical, they're kind of two stories. You know, there's a natural law appeal to anyone, to any interested observer, and then to Catholics specifically. Now, what I think has made that difficult is the apparent disappearance, at least in certain notable instances, like that dreadful Kennedy decision, the mystery clause, where people are, in effect, denying that there's anything like a substantive morality that is shared by citizens of this country. And then the question is, how in the world do you have anything like a society? How in the world do you... I mean, Kennedy, in that awful decision, suggested we have a constitutional right to define reality as we want, as light. Each one does.
This is the Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision.
No, this is private. I mean, you have your view. I have it. You know, it goes back to Protagoras. That's chaotic. I mean, it's quite clearly, I think, incoherent. And no one's consistent, and neither is Justice Kennedy. So in subsequent decisions, he adopts the opposite of that viewpoint. But what's disruptive, I think, is that you have, at least on the level of theory, this notion, you get it in Rorty as well, there's just no there. There's nothing that underpins, in reality, judgments as to right or wrong, or being or non-being, for that matter. And it's only a pragmatic kind of decision that would be made. Well, I don't know what pragmatism would mean if you don't have any underlying basis.
You conceive of Catholic philosophers as bringing some understanding of the underlying or some...
We should have. I mean, what you got in say, the heyday of Catholic philosophy, people like Jacques Maritain and his Walgreen lectures on man and the state, which came after his participation in the Declaration of Human Rights, the UN Declaration of Human Rights. He was the French ambassador to the session in Mexico City that put that together. In Man and the State, what Maritain is asking himself, what is the relationship, we could put it this way, what is the relationship between natural law, as it had been traditionally spoken of and discussed, on the one hand, and natural rights on the other? They seem on the face of it to be quite different. And what Maritain did, what John Finnis does in his book, Natural Law and Natural Rights, is to come up with an argument that, in effect, makes them complementary to one another, so that rights are sort of the flip side of duties and vice versa. So, now, it seems to me one of the problems with a solution like that is that it's very satisfying for the one who makes it, holds natural law, and he could show how he can accommodate. But if you look at proponents, radical proponents of rights theory, they're not going to accept this. They couldn't, you see. So it's an odd kind of solution that isn't a solution for the addressee, but only for the addresser, so to speak. That doesn't make it any less true, but from the point of view of efficaciousness, it sort of is a disconnect.
Your theory of natural law, the theory that you've worked out in books like Ethica Thomistica and that you seem to be holding here, how is it possible that people don't know the natural law? I mean, there are Catholic philosophers or philosophers of natural law who think, well, everybody does at some level know it, and only an act of willfulness could pretend that you didn't.
You see, sometimes the claim seems to be that everyone holds a given theory or account of natural law, and that's pretty counterintuitive. I mean, you can come up with all kinds of instances where that doesn't seem to be the case. Do you hold that there are certain self-evident principles of practical reason? I mean, ask anyone that, and they might say, I never thought about it. But if you begin to talk about Augustine puts it this way, I've met many people who wanted to deceive, but none who wanted to be deceived. Huh? Now, it seems to me you latch on to things like that, and you ask yourself, what does that tell you about a common and shared view about human behavior? That's the kind of thing that would enable you to get to the implicit awareness of natural law principles, as opposed to a theoretical account of that, which can take any number of different forms, not all of them adequate, but you get different theories of natural law, and you get different explanations of the Thomistic theory of natural law as well. But we're all talking about the same thing, and what we're talking about is what I tried to indicate, that in the crunch, when real agents are discussing, arguing about what ought to be done, it's not the case that anything goes. Huh? Yeah. And you want to know what are the things that don't go. And you begin to, you don't have to formulate all these. You don't have to make a list of them. I mean, it's the sort of implicit possibility of people living together and communicating together.
Ralph, at the beginning of On Liberty, John Stuart Mill, at the very beginning, the first couple sentences, dismisses with enormous impatience the idea that anything having to do with the metaphysical question, the logical questions of freedom of the human will has anything to do with the topic he is going to take up, the question of human liberty, meaning political liberty. And he dismisses the idea that those might be linked topics with a great brio of impatience. And launches into his famous, some much dislike, much praised account of political liberty. Yeah. Is he right to do so, or isn't in fact much of your work an argument that he's wrong to do so?
No, I don't think so, because it seems to me that if you argued that somebody has to articulate a metaphysical theory about freedom and so forth before he can talk about what he ought to do. Obviously, that would seem very bizarre, and he would be right to say that doesn't come before what I want to talk about, and I want to. But there's something British about it too, disdaining theory and that kind of thing. So part of it is, I think, contingent, but there's something right about it as well. I want to be careful. I don't want to say that you could really have an adequate moral theory without theism. Huh? But I think you can have the thing that we're talking about without these overt appeals to theoretical issues on another level.
Could you have an adequate politics, a politics of liberty, in a world that disbelieved in freedom of the human will?
I don't see how. I don't see how, because otherwise what you would be saying is, well, what would you be saying? That the whole thing is determined and that would be the usual kind of complaint against Marxism. If you have this inevitable change that's taking place in history, you know, why work for it? I mean, it's going to happen or not. Seemino, the mystery writer, was a determinist in his own views. And I always thought, what a strange thing for a mystery writer to be. Well, it seems to me he's not at all consistent with that theory in his novel. And it seems to me, too, that somebody might call themselves a determinist. A lot of people have. But it's rather hard to live like one. And it'd be almost impossible to live in community on a determinist basis. Because we're constantly asking one another, what is the basic ethical question? Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? And the assumption is that you might have done otherwise, huh? And that you're responsible, you're answerable for what you do. Now, if we try to avoid that by invoking a kind of subterranean theory according to which this is all illusory and we're really being determined by it, that's theoretical. It seems to me what you start with is this recognition of responsibility and of freedom. And the theory is I think, going to fall because it's out of whack with that. There is a sense in which freedom is a self-evident truth. I mean, you don't prove it. It's one of those things from which you begin. And so consequently, if somebody denies it, what you do is not establish its truth so much as show that the denial is untenable. And it seems to me that's what I would do with determinist theory. Yeah. It might take a while. In some case.
Ralph, you've said once or twice or probably many, many times that you're an Aristotelian because you're a Thomist. As you feel connected to the world of Greek philosophy because you've spent your life as a scholar and thinker on St. Thomas Aquinas. What does that mean?
Well, Thomas Aquinas commented on 12 of the treatises of Aristotle, and he did this late in his career, and he did it not in his normal magisterial function as a theologian. This was kind of moonlighting in a way. He started in 1268 with his commentary in the De Anima, and he stopped writing in 1273. So you have 6 years. If he had done nothing but these, he would have been a busy man. But then he went back to Paris for a second stint as a professor and was caught up in all kinds of quarrels, the Latin of Heroism and so forth, and wrote in all kinds of things other than these commentaries. So they clearly are related to that Latin of Heroist controversy. Is Aristotle inimical to or support of Christian belief? But the commentaries themselves, one of the great benefits of having gone to Laval was that the commentaries of Thomas on Aristotle were taken with extreme seriousness. This hasn't characterized every species of Thomist in the 20th century and beyond. I've accounted that one of the great blessings of my training to have seen that. And now you get the strangest tributes to these commentaries, Martha Nussbaum saying that the commentary on the De Anima of Thomas is one of the most perceptive that she knows, and so on. So they're important for Aristotelians. This is the point I'm making. They're not simply Thomas using Aristotle in the commentaries to say things other than what the text is saying. They are efforts to understand the text itself.
Well, the reason I ask the question is because there are those who want to insist that precisely as you raise people like you would raise Catholic issues and Christian themes and natural theology, yeah, much less revealed theology, in a philosophical context, you have ceased to be philosophers.
Yeah.
That you need somehow, you know, Aristotle without Thomas Aquinas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, part of that, there's a long discussion that's gone on in this country for quite a while now, the whole notion of Christian philosophy. Can Christians be philosophers? And you get, on the part of some people, this very secularized notion that in order to be a philosopher, you have to be at least agnostic, if not denying, of religious beliefs. And if you're not open in this sense, you simply are not following the question where it goes. It seems to me you make the distinction between the atmosphere within which you do your philosophical work and the substantive arguments that you devise. Any philosophical argument, if persuasive, has to be persuasive to believer and non-believer. But the setting of the believer very definitely influences the way in which his thinking goes and the kind of thing he's going to look for arguments for. This is true of anyone. The idea that anyone comes to philosophy without any antecedent beliefs, without any convictions, that he just dropped out of the sky someplace and began to ask what is being, is just it's just bizarre. The only difference, it seems to me, is that it's easier to identify what the presuppositions of the believing philosopher are than those of the non-believing philosopher.
But the analytic tradition insists wouldn't say that. You know, you drop out of the sky as a babe newborn. Mm-hmm. They'd say, by very careful training, mm-hmm, you eliminate your prejudices, you eliminate this. I mean, they wouldn't, mm-hmm, to put it that way strikes me as a little bit unfair.
Okay, well, then you forget that you know French or Latin and so forth and try it.
Is that really the answer?
I think so. Yeah, it sounds facetious, but it isn't. I mean, the idea that you can somehow redefine yourself a bovo, and by means of methodic doubt and so forth, just eradicate all you believe, is, I think, bogus. And all you have to do is notice that someone's writing French or Latin to tell you that, and ask yourself, what are the presuppositions of communicating in French and Latin? And the thing begins to wobble. And
so how then do we distinguish? What is the proper distinction between philosophy and theology?
The kinds of arguments that they formulate. The arguments in theology are intrinsically dependent on revealed truths. And if you do not accept those revealed truths, those arguments cannot be a vehicle of truth for you. you might be able to analyze them logically and so forth. But you're not going to come to some new truth from the premises because you don't hold them to be true. Whereas a philosophical argument is based on what is in principle knowable to any human being.
Including God.
Including
some ranging up to philosophical use of God.
Oh, yes, yeah. But the thing is, when you talk about God, you're going to be using principles which are available to any human being, believer or not. And that will be the difference in the arguments. But when you talk about philosophizing, you're talking about a lot more than the nature of the arguments. And the ambience, the culture, the assumptions out of which we reason and argue and in which we live our lives are very influential on the arguments that we formulate or the questions that we raise, the things that we take to be important. And believers are different from non-believers in that regard, and better for it.
Ralph, on his deathbed, a French Catholic philosopher once suggested, a writer once suggested, that the only sadness is not to have been a saint. Looking back over your life, that's the only sadness. Now, it has one of those, you know, kind of exaggerated French feels to it. But I wanted to ask you about this. Does the life of a philosopher deepen as the years go by?
No, that's Léon Blois, and that's a tremendous ending of a great novel, The Woman Who Was Poor. And Blois was, of course, Jacques Maritain's godfather, and had through Maritain, he became known to a lot of us in that novel. Which Sheehan Ward published in translation, was read by people my age with great avidity. And how could you fail to be moved by that kind of summation of what human life is all about? One of the great benefits of being a Catholic philosopher is that you should find it extremely difficult to separate off the aims of the intellectual life from the larger aims of being a Christian. And my great model, of course, is Thomas Aquinas, where you have this fusion of great intellectual talent and achievements with great sanctity. Any Catholic intellectual, I think, this is the great role that Jacques Maritain plays for so many of us. He's a kind of model of putting together the life of the mind and the life of the spirit. We shouldn't lose that, and that's another aspect of the sadness of the Academy. We're all sort of failed clerks in the Academy, in the clerk of Oxenford sense, and to have lost the sense of the relationship of what we're doing, the pursuit of truth to these wider and larger questions is tragic, but it's an occupational hazard for intellectuals to lose their bearings and to lose the sense of why they're doing what they're doing.
Ralph, thank you so much for joining us and discussing these questions in your work and your life.
Jody, you're a patient man.